This lecture is about Spike Lee's Do the Right Thing. I will be following the lecture notes that I've already put up for you quite systematically. Though of course, there are many things I'll be able to say here which are not in the lecture notes. The movie came out in 1989. That's 30 years ago. Yet, it seems like it's a movie of our times, if anything. It even more seems a movie of our times because of all the attention to police brutality against African Americans that we are now aware of because of the Black Lives Matter movement. And I should say right at the beginning that I am very, very sympathetic to that movement. Now, go back to 1989 when this movie came out. You were in a situation where you were at the end of the period during which Ronald Reagan was president of the United States. Reagan is now regarded by Republicans and others of that kind as one of the great presidents that the United States had. What African Americans will primarily remember of him is that he was probably the most racist president that the United States had seen in an entire generation. One story illustrates that more than anything else. A huge political movement, both on campuses and nationwide, in the 1980s was the anti-apartheid movement. Part of whose domestic goals was to achieve divestment of all investments that were made in South Africa because of its policy of apartheid, which universally was regarded as being abhorrent. Now, as that movement, the movement relied very much on students, but above all, it relied on involvement of African-American politicians and the Black church. And that's where the movement grew out of. It is a major feature of the movement that it became, that it captured the popular imagination to such an extent in the United States that the end of apartheid became a domestic civil rights issue for us and was perceived as that. One consequence of that is that Congress voted overwhelmingly to impose sanctions on South Africa, prevent investment in certain companies, prevent direct flights between the United States and South Africa, and similar measures. Reagan vetoed that law, that piece of legislation, and for the first time during his presidency, Congress overrode his veto and imposed those sanctions. So that's the atmosphere in which the movie came out. Now, one aspect of that period, though, is that even though getting rid of apartheid was absolutely important, focusing so much on apartheid ended up not necessarily being the best thing to achieve racial equality or racial justice within the United States, because it allowed attention to shift to the problem of racism elsewhere and not focus at all in the US. And believe me, we had problems here. I'll talk about a few of those in a second, and then I'll remind you of where we are at the University of Texas at Austin. So I was, at that time, a graduate student at the University of Chicago, which was a white island in the middle of an African-American, primarily African-American ghetto, the south side of Chicago. The university ran buses throughout its campus, which was laid out over quite a large area and penetrated into the Hyde Park neighborhood, as it was called, in all directions. In these buses, which was supposed to be for University of Chicago faculty, staff, and students, if a white person got onto them, that white person was never challenged to show an ID. Whereas if an African-American person got into one of those buses, he or she was immediately asked for an ID. And the university wasn't even aware that this racist practice was going on until I raised it at a rally in which I did try to connect what was happening in South Africa with domestic racism. You should also pay attention to it at the University of Texas because of our own situation. Everybody here knows that certain Confederate statues were removed from campus recently, but the glaring and most obvious example of tolerance of racism on campus is that we have a building, the RLM building, which houses two of our major departments, physics and mathematics, on campus, and it's named RLM after Robert Lee Moore, who was a faculty member in mathematics at this university. What people avoid mentioning is that Moore was an open racist. He refused to teach any class in which African Americans would be present, and on one occasion he arrived to hear a mathematics seminar given by a professor who had actually been a graduate student of one of Moore's own graduate students. And when he arrived at the seminar, he realized for the first time that the speaker was African American, and he immediately walked out of the room and refused to attend it. That is the kind of person Moore was, and our own African American students now have to go and take classes in a building named after him. So that's the situation. It has not ended very much. So let's go back to Spike Lee, okay, and Do the Right Thing. So it comes out at that period. Back in the 1980s, late 1980s, we had the usual myths about how racism was geographically distributed across the United States. The South, of course, was supposed to be racist, and the North and the East were supposed to be not. And you had these liberal cities like Chicago, Boston, New York, all of which almost uniformly voted Democratic, at least at the federal level. This was a period when New York had its first African-American mayor, only African-American mayor, David Dinkins. That's the period we're talking about. Yet in all of these cities, whether it's Chicago, whether it's Boston, or whether it's New York, the local reality was much, much more complicated. And that these cities included neighborhoods which were basically so hostile to African Americans that they dared not enter it. Lee explores this in a 1991 film, though that particular issue does not come out to the same extent in this film itself. The 1991 film is one where the same areas of New York are explored as in this film, and that is areas of Brooklyn and Queens. So Lee's movie examines exactly what happens in one of these African-American communities over there, and we are dealing with the fact that in the middle of the community are a few businesses that are not African-American, and an Asian-American store, and then, of course, a pizzeria that's run by Italian-Americans, Sal's Pizzeria, and that had been around there for a long, long time. And then, of course, you know the whole story of what happens, and we will turn to the details of the story in a second. Let me situate it more. Spike Lee was already fairly well known, but generally to a small and somewhat cult-like audience. His original movie was quite interesting, humorous, and controversial. She's Gotta Have It, because of the amount of sex that was in the movie. The second movie, School Days, was one that was seen by a much smaller audience, and that was even more interesting because it began to took a very hard look at a conflict within the African American community between those that regarded themselves still as being African and those who regarded themselves as being American. And this was a political divide in the community that, at least on university campuses and other academic forums, was fairly important. And then he comes out with Do the Right Thing. And lots of people to this day think that it is probably his best movie. Certainly it was the most influential one. And once it came out, and because of its reception, Lee became a well-known cultural icon in the United States. And everybody knew all about him, his love for the Yankees, especially his love for the Knicks, and so on. So I'm moving on. I've already gone through points one in your lecture notes, and points two, we've mentioned that. And I am right now, again, I just went through the points three and four. I am now going on to point five and talking about the internal structure and features of the film. And then I will, of course, turn to the politics of the movie, which is what correctly got the most attention, both from critics, commentators, both people who liked it and people who disliked the movie. Now, the movie itself is remarkable because it has, in some sense, in a joking way, it pays full respect to what classical tragedy, that's tragedy as defined in the context of ancient Greece, what Aristotle celebrates in the Poetics, that's what it seems to satisfy completely. There's unity of time, okay, more or less. That is, everything that is portrayed in the movie, the time it takes within the movie is not much more than the time it takes in real life for those events to happen. And unity of place, you don't move away from one area to another at a time, during a time period that would not be sufficient for you to move from that one period to the other in the real world itself. Obviously, almost nothing that you see in theater today satisfy either unity of time or unity of place, certainly not unity of time. Nevertheless, this movie actually does. The entire stuff happens in one day. Okay, it's a 24-hour period, not even a whole day, actually. And it all takes place in one brownstone block and around one brownstone block of the Bedford Stuyvesant area in Brooklyn, New York. All the action goes on there. And just as in the Greek tradition, there's even a chorus that comments on what's happening in the as part of the action of the theater. And this chorus now consists of the corner men, that is, of Coconut Sid, ML, and Sweet Dick Willie. There is this ironic classicism all about it. What's even more interesting, perhaps, about the movie is that it is it does not build up tension and then release tension at the end. I mean, this is where it goes nothing like what you expect classical Greek tragedy to be alike. Rather, it's a series of vignettes. You need to get one story here, one story there, one story there. And sometimes the stories are all strung along like beads on a string. And sometimes, and each of these stories independently gets developed. You learn through a series of episodes over the whole movie how Lee has a child and how he's trying to make money. Lee, here I mean Mookie, the character, has a child, and how making enough money to feed the child is absolutely critical to his life and the life of his partner. You also see the interactions between his sister and Sal. And you see all the racist stuff coming out of Sal's sons. And you see a bit here, a bit later. Yeah, so there are multiple threads. And they're being weaved together. And they're all flowing in a small amount of time. And then at the end, you have two crises. The most important one, of course, is going to be the murder by the police of Radio Rahim for no very good reason, as people acknowledge. And then finally, of course, there's the act of arson, where Sal's pizzeria is burned out. And then the concluding scene, of course, is this weird one where Mookie and Sal argue about the money. And then initially Mookie pretends that he does not want the full $500 and returns $200 to Sal, who does not really accept it. But ultimately Mookie goes down literally onto the ground, ceding the upper ground to Sal, and picks up the money because clearly he's going to need it now, presumably because he's no longer going to have a job at the pizzeria. Now, the other part, of course, you should remember with the movie is that at the technical level, it is absolutely superbly made. Okay? The cinematography is quite magnificent, and the way in which everything is portrayed, we even seem to feel the heat of the summer day. And everything that is done to cope with the heat, and we seem to get a really good, realistic picture of what our life is like in that community. Of course, it's not realistic at all in the movie. It's very intentionally ironic, and all kinds of structures are being used that we seem to lose somewhat. Mm-hmm. So that's the movie, beautifully made, addresses the issue of racism and all of that. So I am at this point at about 0.7 in the handout that you have in front of you. Let me say that when the movie came out, okay, liberal white critics generally gave it a very poor review, arguing that it was an invitation to rioting, making all kinds of claims about Spike Lee's intentions, Spike Lee's politics, and all of that. And a lot of these reviewers, of course, came from New York. These are reviewers who regarded New York as a liberal city and were deeply offended, in fact, insulted that their city had been portrayed in this way, when clearly in their mind, their city was a bastion of liberal politics, had no serious issues with racism or any of that sort of stuff. And it would not be completely unfair to claim that by and large, these reviews themselves suffered from the same prejudices, the same racist prejudices that Lee was trying to criticize in the movie. And that's something worth remembering. And I cite a piece by Y. Willis, which actually, if you go and read the piece, you will see that it refers to a lot of these movies and what they claimed about the film itself. Now, the film itself, what do we make of it? People have been arguing about its politics, what its message can be, for a long, long time. I mean, for all the 30 years ever since it came out. And two questions that I call a trillion-dollar questions. First, in point 8, is Sal a racist? And I will worry a fair amount about that. And then the other one, which I raise in point 11, which is, what is the political message of the movie? It tells you to do the right thing, going by its title, what is the right thing? And that's far from clear. And we could spend a lot of time worrying about it and maybe achieving no resolution at all in terms of what it is. In between, of course, is the issue is there are two other issues, which is point 9, which is the movie really in Spike Lee's voice? What is the voice of the movie? How close is the identification between Mookie and Spike Lee, Spike Lee's own politics and all of that? And then, of course, what is the extent to which Spike Lee was speaking for all blacks, as they would be called then, African Americans, as the preferred term is now? So there is four issues. Let's start with this: is Sal a racist issue? Well, it is clear he can use racially offensive terms, terms that we, whether or not it's because of political correctness or whether it's a genuinely good and important political choice, terms that we would not use now. Okay, terms that are unacceptable to use and should have been unacceptable back then. And does the fact that he uses the term in the 1980s make him a racist? Now, you have to remember, those terms were used by people like Lincoln and LBJ, and they're not people whom we would normally call racist. And whereas using some of these derogatory terms is certainly grounds for calling somebody a racist now in our political context, would it suffice to call that person a racist because of using those terms in the 1980s? Now, we also have an added puzzle to this, that there is extensive documentation of what exactly Lee was doing with the script when he was composing it and what he intended to show. And there's no doubt that he thought that Sal was a racist, right, and all that. But just because he thought that Sal was a racist, our concluding, therefore, that Sal, as portrayed in the movie, is a racist, would be a fallacy, an example of the intentionalist fallacy. Because in some sense or the other, what happens on screen can be interpreted differently and better by what it implicitly does than by what the director explicitly thought he or she was doing with that particular movie. Moreover, in between what the script does and what we see in the movie is the mediation of the actor. And this is where something really interesting comes out, that Aiello, the actor who portrayed Sal, after reading the script, decided that Sal was not a racist, that Sal made a mistake when he went into this invective-laden thing, a big mistake. But nevertheless, in some sense or the other, he was a good person. Not only was he not a racist, he was actually a good person. And we can sort of see some evidence of that in Sal's many interactions with African-American customers who come into his shop. I mean, it's clear that his sons are racist, but that does not make him a racist in that sense. In particular, he has a rather good relationship with Mookie's sister, who seems to respond to that relationship. Mookie, of course, thinks that that relationship is much too sexual for him to be comfortable with it, but there is lots and lots of rooms for interpretation that Mookie seems to be suffering from some sort of a desire to protect his sister, which is not completely appropriate in that context, given what the sister, who is of age, wants herself. Now, so Sal is complicated. At the other end, and the question as to whether or not he happens to be a racist cannot simply be answered by invoking either Lee's own intentions or his invectively laden speech. So we should keep that in mind. We should also keep in mind that what we are debating is something that is that cannot be resolved in all circumstances, even today. Of course, and from our contemporary perspective, every time we debate racism, we should also keep in mind that the whole issue is completely unfounded, in the sense that racism is based on an assumption that biologically there are these well-defined things called races, and as any legitimate philosopher of biology will tell you, it's simply not true that you can divide up human beings into a discrete set of groups that correspond to what we culturally call races. Of course, saying that race itself is not a valid category does not take away the problem of racism. The problem of racism depends on the perception that there are different races, and that some races are supposed to be better for whatever reason than other races, and all of that. So we have lots and lots of reasons to be very, very skeptical of trying to give a pat and easy answer to the question whether Sal is a racist. At the end of the day, I suppose I myself am sympathetic to Spike Lee's view, that is, that yes, Aiello might say that there is some good in him and all of that, but overall, what Sal's invective shows is that deep down he has and shares many of the prejudices that his sons actually have. Let me leave it at that, and leave it as a topic that we can discuss further when we have our online in-person meetings, and also something that you might want to take up if you decide to write a paper about this movie. The second issue, of course, and I'm going to be even shorter on this one, is the question of the extent to which this movie is narrated in Spike Lee's voice. Is Mookie exactly representing what Lee is trying to do with the movie as a whole? And there is good reason to think yes. After all, in some sense, even though Sal is the most complicated and perhaps the central character of the film, the other one is Mookie. And Mookie is the one who carries out the final act of arson that horrifies certain critics, and at the other end might well seem to be liberating from the point of view of African Americans who have been victims of systematic racism and exploitation over generations. And more than that, we see Mookie's perspective impinge on the movie all the time, even when it appears to be the case that it is not completely well-founded, for example, in dealing with the relationship between his sister and Sal. But that's where you additionally see a complexity. If Mookie/Lee thinks Sal is a racist, then there is particular reason why, even independent of all the sexual issues, why Mookie/Sal would not want to see his sibling have any kind of a close emotional bonding with such a person. So whatever it is, Mookie's perspective is a dominant one in the film. But we might also say that Spike Lee does not actually approve of how Mookie relates to his partner, what it means for him to have a child that he's not supporting properly, and a variety of other things. Much that we deplore Radio Rahim's murder, it's far from clear that Spike Lee himself is as sympathetic to the character as Mookie appears to be. And we could spend a fair amount of time where we discuss this, and this is one of those wonderful cases where there can be multiple interpretations of the film that are all equally valid, in the sense that they are to the same extent supported by the evidence that's present in the details of the film. And I will leave it at that, since I am not trying to extend this lecture into something that goes on for more than half an hour. Then, of course, the question comes up. This is point 10 in your handout. Does Spike Lee speak for all African Americans? Now, because the reaction of white critics to Do the Right Thing was so unnecessarily hostile by and large, I mean, not everybody was that critical. You have the piece by Mitchell, which takes a very rather sympathetic look at what Lee is up to. But given that, and given that the movie itself, everybody had to acknowledge its technical brilliance, the movie acquired iconic status. And once it did that, African Americans tended to coalesce around what was so important and what was so good about the movie, and that is what and those who were sympathetic to, you know, to the issues that African Americans were facing, people such as me also coalesced around a defense of the movie. And so it is almost impossible to find adequate data to answer the question, the extent to which Spike Lee did capture what African Americans as a whole felt, or whether he only captured it in broad outline, where, for example, they all agree that the death police murder of African Americans was not exactly desirable, and they all accepted that the basic structural relations of a lot of the United States in the 1980s, including neighborhood relationships within cities like Chicago, Boston, and New York, were very racist. So Lee captures all of that, but he may not capture the fact that many African Americans may not have been very happy with Radio Raheem's behavior, or exactly exactly the extent to which that the confrontations that were induced by the young African Americans were not really something that was approved on by all members of the community. So there is complexity there. But the complexity is also there within the movie. It's not clear that everything that is being portrayed in the movie, even if it is portrayed as something that is part of the life of that community, is being portrayed as something that we should all encourage, or all African Americans should encourage, or things of that sort. So let me say that the reception of the movie was such that, by and large, at least in its major themes, the movie came to reflect what was felt by a very large segment of African Americans, at least in urban environments. Beyond that, we just simply do not have data. And this question, quite frankly, is not as interesting as the other political questions that this movie raised. So let me end with point 11. And that is our second trillion-dollar question. What is the political message of the movie? What is the right thing? Now, the first thing I want to mention is that, look, we see two things in the movie that can be criticized. One is a murder. The other is the arson. And one extremely prevalent racist fallacy that was around in discussions of the movie after it came out is a pretense that these are equivalent to each other. Murder is not the same thing as arson. Okay? And in particular, going beyond that, harm done to people is not ethically, morally on par to harm done to property. It is far from clear, for example, that even if we are willing to defend somebody killing somebody else in order to protect his or her own life or the life of other persons, that it is equally permissible to kill someone to defend a piece of property. Capitalism might try to instill such a view on you, but this view is actually not very reasonable. Property does not have the same status as persons have. In fact, arguably, property does not even have the same status as sentient beings have. That is, it is far worse to, say, kill a bull or a cow or a pig than it is to burn down a pizzeria. So we should keep that in mind. That said, maybe the real strangely appropriate thing that we see in the movie is that Mookie's arson prevented violence to persons, right? That by burning down the pizzeria, he allowed all the tension that had built up in the community, all the hostility that was being directed, perhaps correctly, towards Sal and his sons, all that tension could dissipate without actually any physical harm done to them. In that sense, Mookie really did the right thing. He prevented harm to people by carrying out arson, and in carrying out arson, he also, at the same time, even though this is not his major purpose, managed to find expression of some of the community anger towards what happened. And that was the right thing to do. Now, I'm sure this particular reading is not going to convince all of you, but I hope at least for some of you, it will make you rethink what the movie is about. And that might even be the basis for what you write about the movie if you come to write about it. I'm going to stop there and leave it for you to ask me questions on Thursday. Okay.